Hi, everybody. It's me, Austin, from the podcast, the one that you're listening to right now, the one that I do every week from my apartment and sometimes other places. It's called People Pleaser, and it's this one. Hi, welcome back. How are you? How's your new year going? How's 2022 so far? It's only been a few days. Are you still doing your resolutions? Or are they kind of more like ethereal ones where you're like, I'm trying to commit to being more open to what life has to offer me. So it's sort of like hard to tell whether you're actively doing it, but you can kind of tell yourself throughout the day, like, no, I am. Like, I'm setting an intention to be more open to things. And that's what my new year is going to be. What kind of resolutions did you do? Or did you say, like, I'm going to eat everything that I buy from the grocery store? I'm going to make sure that my groceries don't go bad. Was that your resolution? Something really actionable that you can measure like that? And so right now you're sitting there looking at a bag of spinach that you bought and you're like, I need to figure out what I'm going to put all that spinach into. Throwing spinach into shakes in the morning, throwing spinach on sandwiches and salads, just throwing spinach into everything because you got to hold up your end of the bargain with that resolution. Is that what you did? Or did you say stuff just kind of like, this year I'm going to be easier on myself. I'm going to forgive myself and I'm going to be nicer to myself. And then that way it's sort of more of a free floating thing. And I think you can measure that. I'm not saying that either one is better or worse than the other. I'm just generally asking. Hey, it's the show. A few things before we get started. Some ways that you can support this show. Patreon.com/AustinArcher. It's a fantastic way to support everything that I do, from TikTok to Instagram to Twitter to YouTube to this show right here. The people who support me over on Patreon are just... I mean, what else can be said about these people, about these selfless, incredible people who are helping this show and all of the stuff that I do succeed and thrive? Thank you to all of those people so much. So much. Thank you. And to anyone else who wants to jump on for the new year, we'd love to have you. AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com. All my albums are there. I made a post about this earlier this week on social media because about several times a week, probably 3 or 4 times a week, someone comments on a video of mine and says, "You should really think about releasing an album." And I always think to myself, "You know what? They're right. That's a really good idea. I should do that again after having done it several times before already." And I think I wonder if there's some kind of link in the bio of all of my social medias that someone could just go click on and just take a look and just see if I've ever, you know, if they have the question, I wonder if this guy's ever released an album. They could go just check, maybe even just Google me, just look it up. Like, does Austin Archer have an album on Spotify or Apple Music? Instead of just going to the comments section and assuming that I don't. But you all know that. Everyone that listens to this podcast knows that. But, you know, it's something. It's something. If you're a person who listens to my music on Spotify or Apple Music, thank you so much. But if you've never purchased any of my music, maybe consider it. But also you might want to hold off because there is a physical thing coming out soon that's going to be a double vinyl of a special edition of my album, Beautiful Things. It's going to be out in like a month. So maybe you want to hold off till then. I don't know. But that's a great way to support. My Venmo is linked in my bio. Like maybe PayPal or Patreon is too much of a commitment. And you're like, I can't commit to a monthly recurring payment. But like my Venmo is on all of the all in my bio. You click on that link. My Venmo's down at the bottom. If you just want to like send a one time like, hey, here's $20. Just a one time. Hey, thanks for all the stuff, you know, I'd also accept that. And if on principle, don't do money. Monetary support, or you just can't afford it. Totally understand that. Maybe you want to just share one of these episodes of this podcast, or just tell a friend about it, or go to Apple Podcasts and give the show a 5-star rating and write a review. We're not going to do review the review on this episode, but that is a thing that we do. Is if you go to Apple Podcasts, give the show a 5-star rating and write a review, I read the review on the air. So that's something you could do. Just subscribing to the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, just so that it just boosts it in the algorithm. All that stuff, and really just being here, being here and listening to the show is enough. Of course, you don't have to go above and beyond. There is no barrier to entry on consuming the show. That's my spiel at the top of the show. Let's get into the show. Interesting choice that I'm making here. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you know that frequently when I have a guest on, I will do a written intro. I will actually sit down and take the time and put in the effort to write out my thoughts at the top of the show and do a nice written intro. And I try to perform it nicely and make it really nice. And listen, I'm not trying to make excuses, but that's exactly what I'm doing. I've been very, very busy. It's not just with work, and I'm working a lot. Like, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm in LA right now. I'm back in the one bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. But I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm going to film a movie, for like the next 7 days. And I have been busy with work, but I've also been out of town for the holidays, and I've just been living out of suitcases, and I've been going here and there and everywhere and just dodging Omicron like a madman. I mean, it's crazy with the amount of places that I've gone and the amount of different people that I've worked with that I haven't gotten sick yet. I imagine I'm gonna. I really do. I imagine at some point I'm just gonna, but somehow you know, like Jim Carrey in The Mask when they're trying to shoot him and he's bouncing around like a cartoon character. That's me with Omicron and with COVID in general. I haven't, as far as I know, I have yet to contract the coronavirus in any one of its iterations. I have not been diagnosed or received a positive test in all of the 2 years. How crazy is that? You know, and I'm not doing like the best job of locking down, but I mean, you know, I work from home, and when I'm out, I wear a mask and I'm triple vaxxed. So, you know, I think I'm doing more than like some people, but I don't think that I'm not, you know, head to toe in plastic when I go outside. You know, I've flown on planes. But anyway, I digress. My point is I've been busy. Okay. And it's interesting because in this episode, my guest, Jeff Talbot, and I talk about how we both enjoy having written something, having a final product, having something that we just wrote, but we don't enjoy the process of writing. And we're talking about plays, which writing a play, it's a big old matzo ball. You know, it's not quite as large as like writing a novel or, you know, but it is. I mean, but it's a big thing. It takes weeks, months. Sometimes years to finally have a version of the play that you're happy with. It's a big ol' undertaking. Whereas these intros that I write for this show, I usually write them like in an afternoon. It usually takes me about an hour to sit down and write it. But it's like I don't enjoy the process of sitting down and writing. It is something that I have to be in the right space to be able to sit down and do it and be fluid and flow and let it kind of come out. But what I do like being able to present to you a nicely written intro. I like having written an intro. I like reciting the written intro. I like, you know, polishing it up and making it sound nice. I like that part. But it's the whole process of it, and that's what we're talking about on the show. So I'm sort of doing in a weird way, I'm making this work. I'm making it like a little meta commentary on writing. I always like telling people who found me on TikTok or on Instagram, and now we're listening to this podcast, or people who just listen to the podcast, things about me that they might not know. I remember I did an episode about drag once with my friend Devin, and I was like, you might not know this about me, but I'm a huge drag fan. I love drag. I like telling people things about me that I don't know because I think it's easy to meet someone in a parasocial way on the internet and think you sort of have an idea of who they are. For most of you just think that I'm like a singer-songwriter who kind of happens to make silly sketches. And then like sometimes you find out tangentially, you'll be watching like a TV show and you're like, oh my gosh, there's Austin, or like, you know, and you realize, oh, he's an actor too. That makes sense. That's why he's doing all the skits. But there are other things that a lot of people don't know about me that I like peppering in there from time to time. I love telling people that I'm a choreographer. That's one of my favorite things to do, is to choreograph dance pieces. And I haven't been able to choreograph something in a minute, but like, I've been able to choreograph some like pretty big things in my time, and things that I'm really proud of. And another thing that I think most people who follow me on social media have no idea about is that I'm a playwright who's had a couple plays produced. Okay, did you know that? Did you know that I've had a few plays that I've written, put on by actors and directed by people who weren't me, and put on by a theater company that they did a play that I wrote, and that happened. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of both the plays that I've had produced. I've only had two produced, but I'm proud of both of them, and I've written a few more. But my guest today is a good friend of mine. We met doing a play at Pioneer Theater Company. We were, well, not a play, a musical. We were doing the Putnam County Spelling Bee, and we became fast friends, and I instantly kind of fell in love with him. He's so funny and smart and talented, and he's such a great actor. And little did I know that he is actually a very accomplished and very talented and very skilled playwright. So when I say I'm a playwright and that I've written a few plays, this guy is like the real deal. He's actually written a lot more plays than I have, and he's had his plays produced at theaters that are much bigger and can hold a much bigger audience, and he's had many, 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 many more productions of his plays produced over the years than I have. And that's great, because when it comes to the topic that we're discussing, it means that I got to learn a lot. And those are my favorite episodes. I love when I get to learn about something that I'm interested in or passionate about, because if I'm learning, it means that you have a chance of learning. So what I will say at the top here is that my guest today is a very smart, very humble, very talented, very funny person who I just love and adore. And if you're in Salt Lake or in Utah, in the area, his play, The Messenger, is coming out at Pioneer Theater in Salt Lake City. It's one of the premier regional theaters in the Western United States, and he has had a few plays produced there, and this is his latest. It's fantastic. Rush to go see it if you can. If you're not in Utah, still listen to this episode, because it's just a great look at the creative process, and you'll get to hear from a guy who is very good at what he does and offers very good insight into his process and his creative process. And yeah, okay, so I didn't write something, but that's okay, right? That's it. That's what I wanted to say. And you got it. And it's got a little bit more personality because it's off the cuff. But yeah, it's like I should have written something for this episode about writing, but it's almost like I don't want to try to like write something that I'm trying to like impress Jeff, or he's going to listen to the episode and I'm going to be like, well, listen to my writing, Jeff. He's already heard the episodes where I wrote stuff. He listens to this show. So he's heard me write things, and he's aware that it's something that I like to do. And I do like writing the intros, because it's a nice exercise for me as a writer, just to write anything, even if it's a short little blurb. But I just didn't have the time today. I had a lot of things going on. I'm traveling tomorrow. I got to pack up to go do this movie. I got to work on my lines, all that stuff. But I really enjoyed having this conversation with my good friend, Jeff Talbot. So from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, except we weren't in, I'm in the one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood right now, but we were actually in Jeff's temporary apartment in Salt Lake, where he is working on his play. This is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my very good friend, Jeff Talbot, about playwriting. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Austin.
How you doing?
I'm good.
We can pretend like we haven't been talking to each other for
2 hours? Yeah, yes. Yeah. I am sad we're not in a blanket fort. I feel cheated a little bit.
Nobody is anymore. It's now just a concept. It was for like the first 6 months of the show, it was a blanket fort.
Right.
And ever since, it's just been the idea of a blanket fort.
Then I am in the blanket fort.
You are.
Yeah.
You are conceptually.
I'm in the blanket fort nation.
Yep. If you're talking on the show, then
nice.
You are. Then you are conceptually. Anyone on Zoom in another place, they're in the blanket fort.
Achievement unlocked.
Yeah.
Now here I am.
I do think about maybe going back to it just on my end, even though I'm Zooming. I feel like I should like set it up just so that they can see the guest and they yes. can feel, like put some lights up or something and make it yes. feel like we're
yes.
a little.
Yes. You know,
yeah, but it's just a lot of work.
Of course.
And I don't want to do
and
that.
And you're living in the space, so.
Yeah. I won't have to put it up and take exactly. it down every time.
Yes.
So, okay. You've written a lot of plays.
I have.
And I've seen a few of them. I saw I, gorgeous play. I saw Gravedigger's Lullaby, which I really, really loved. I think I saw
Thanks,
a workshop of something else at the Actors.
You might have. Yes, when you were in New York. Yeah, I can't remember. They developed a lot of my stuff, yeah. so I don't remember what you saw. So.
I can't remember what the other one was. And then yeah. I've read half of this one
of
now.
The new thing.
Uh-huh. And you're very good at it.
Thank
and,
you.
I wonder, in all of the time that you've been doing it, have you consciously or unconsciously developed a go-to process, or is it different with everyone?
Gosh, I mean, I don't know if my go-to process is to feel totally lost and beaten down by it and just continue to do it until I don't feel beaten down by it, which is somewhere probably near the end of a draft.
Yeah.
Because it isn't digging ditches, but I do find, like most writers, I agree with, I think it was Dorothy Parker who, when asked, do you enjoy writing? She said, I enjoy having written.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, I enjoy having written. Because my favorite thing, and this is where we are now, because we're talking about my play, The Messenger, which is in rehearsal right now at Pioneer Theater Company.
Yeah. Plug.
I know.
Anyone in
Salt
Lake.
I did it so smoothly
yeah,
too, right? Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was great. Uh-huh.
But... what did I just say? Oh, about having written.
Yes.
My favorite part is you get a draft out, mm-hmm. and I know there are some writers who finish a draft and are like, that's what I meant. And they know that there's a longer process to developing it, but I really believe that once I finished 120 pages or whatever a first draft is, there's the clay, now let's make the thing. Mm. And it requires other people to make the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is my favorite part. Doesn't mean that I don't have opinions. It doesn't mean that I also don't have a goal in sight for what I want it to be when it's done. Mm-hmm. But once other voices are in the room, first a director and then actors, it's my favorite part. And I think something that separates me, there are several things that separate me from a lot of writers, but I think the common chorus that now that I've done this enough mm-hmm. that comes from people that I'm working with is you're so open to being wrong.
Yeah,
and my answer often, if somebody says, I don't understand this, I usually say, and it's true, I have the same question too.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. And I know when it's good, but usually I know it's good because I don't remember having written it. So I yeah. watch, if we get to the point in a rehearsal process where I'm watching it, I no longer, it all seems unrecognizable to me. I know I'm kind of onto something.
Yeah. You're actually getting lost in what, yes. in the work the actors are doing, in the way that they're bringing it to life. And you're actually,
yeah. And
going,
I don't remember writing those words.
Yeah.
Because a big check mark that something isn't working is if the writer's like, yeah, that's a really cool turn of phrase.
Well, I talk about this in songwriting all the time, that I think some of my best songs are the ones that came out really easy and that I don't really feel a yeah. whole lot of responsibility for, where I'm like, that song kind of fell out of my face
right.
and I don't really know where that came from, but I like it and I hear it. And especially, I think actors performing work, it's kind of like, I've had a few people do covers of my songs before
yes.
and I get to hear someone else do it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm like, oh damn, that's a good song. That's yeah. a good lyric. Like that, you know, and just hearing someone else do it. But also it's usually with the ones that I don't feel like I came up with that. It just feels like that
right.
that happened because I was in it. I was in the state of flow. I was in a space.
I was
space.
Just going to talk about flow.
Yeah.
yeah. Uh-huh. Because there's this great, I don't know if you've read, there's this great, I think he's Polish architect who's written a book about this. It's kind of unreadably pedantic. Mm-hmm. But that idea of getting to a space when you're writing where you don't notice that you're writing anymore,
yeah.
I call it the golden hour for me
mm-hmm.
because if I set out, I'm a 9-to-5-er. Like yeah. I get up and I go for a long walk and I'm always writing. Like I'm always in my head
yep.
in the middle of some idea. But sitting down at a keyboard, I think it's hell.
Isn't it so frustrating when you've really got it on a walk? You're out on a walk okay. and you've got it.
You can't.
You can hear it and you're like,
but
oh,
it doesn't happen. But I find that if I stay at the computer, like a lot of writers, if I stay at it for long enough, there's mm-hmm. In Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Brick talks about the click
mm-hmm.
when he's drinking. There's mm-hmm. a click.
Yeah.
Well, I find that to be true in writing, mm-hmm. where if I go long enough, there's a click and I feel it happening and I'm no longer kind of consciously present.
Yeah.
And that's exciting and exhilarating. It's also exhausting. So it lasts for me somewhere between 60 to 90 minutes. And if that, and I know when it ends too, like it clicks off and I'm starting to write crap again.
Yeah.
Then I'm like, great. What a great day.
Yeah.
And however long that was, I got some stuff and I'll come look at it tomorrow, but I'm going to leave it alone and let it kind of be there on a computer. And tomorrow I'll look at it and probably cut half of it, but I know that something happened there and I don't remember doing it.
I think that that's, I don't know that I've ever actually gotten to that point on this show before, because I talk to a lot of people in the, who do creative stuff, but that if I'm working a full day on content or something like that, I might be lucky if I get 2 good hours.
Sure.
Just like
that's
that.
Right.
Where I'll be there the whole day kind of coming up with ideas, setting things up, shooting stuff, trying things out, and maybe I'll get 2 good hours. Maybe. Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
That's a lucky day.
Of flow and where I really feel like I was...
Yeah,
I was working it.
But that takes, I think, really abandoning ego too.
Yeah.
As a writer, I often say this, like it is just ego. Trying to manhandle a play or a musical or a song into something that you want it to be is a recipe for having it not be good. But it's also ego.
Yeah.
Giving up on that and just turning yourself over to it. I think of it as a living organism. I think of the play as a thing. It's not a child, but it is something we all in the room are trying to help be what it wants to be.
Yeah.
And if it's telling you what it is, I always think I'm writing a comedy.
Yeah.
Which I think you would think, knowing my work, is hilarious because they always turn out to be tragic.
Yeah.
But when I start, I'm like, this one's going to be funny. And they always turn out to be something else.
Yeah.
But I, 100% of the time, my experience is, and this is true of all the platforms that I write on, whatever I think it's going to be when I start, it is definitely not that when I'm done.
Yeah, yeah.
Every time.
I sit down all the time thinking, I'm going to write a song that's going to sound like an Elliott Smith song or something. And then by the time I'm done, it sounds like an Austin Archer song.
Of course it does.
Because it does.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just can't help myself. And it's fine, and you know, but accepting that too. And that's, I always tell people, like, you're not going to be able to help being yourself if you just...
Right.
If you, like you said, try to get the ego out of it and just sort of just sit down and do it.
And let the thing tell you, which is true of acting too. Yeah. You know, like you think your job is saying things, but your job is actually listening to things.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to figure that out as an actor.
Yeah.
A long time. And once I got to that, I was like, oh, it's so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to know what I say next. I got to memorize that. I got to do the technical stuff. But once I've done all the technical work, now I just need to sit and talk to this other person.
And let you affect me.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to affect you. I don't have to sit at home and figure out what it's going to sound like.
Yeah.
It's going to sound different every time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
But it's going to be within the constraints of the world that we've set up and agreed on together.
Yeah.
And that is true of writing a play. Like we're all agreeing what this world is. But it's going to tell us. Let's let it tell us.
Yes, I love that. I mean, so I'm obsessed with, I love having written. I don't like writing because that's exactly how I feel, especially writing a play or a screenplay or anything like that. And I think, you know, plays and screenplays are interesting when you finish them because they really... It's not anything if it's not going to get made.
I know.
It's just a thing that's going to sit on your computer that maybe you can pass around to some friends, like have somebody look at it. But
having your friends like it is weak tea.
Yeah.
It becomes a reward that isn't a reward at some point. You're like, yes, I'm so glad you like it. You're my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I want somebody who doesn't know me, who has no investment in me, to like it or be affected by it.
Yes.
They actually don't have to like it.
Yeah.
Be affected by it.
Yes. Yes. And having that process, I was going to ask, I mean, you sort of already answered it, but...
Well, then we're done.
Yeah.
It was a really short episode. It was great.
It was fantastic. That's it. But just, do you... Because some people, actors or singers, they don't like watching themselves. Like, they don't like watching a video of themselves performing or listening to a recording of their own voice.
Right.
I feel like it's a little bit different hearing actors say your words. Do you like the process of listening to
it? I love it.
I
love it.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But I really do. And I really do love interpretation. I really do love an actor will bring something to it that is not what I expected.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I will have an opinion and be like, I actually think that line is this. But I love it. I'm also, and this comes from starting as an actor, I think I think whatever success I've had as an actor, and it's, and it, there are people who think I'm better at it than I probably think I am. But I do think one of the things that I offer it is I'm left-footed. Like I come at things. You're like this too, mm-hmm. as an actor. I often, and it's not some calculated thing, but as an actor, I come at it from an angle that isn't necessarily what is the first choice. I usually reach beyond choice A to choice B.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it when actors do that. Mm-hmm. I also have no problem saying if I think choice A is probably what it's telling us it wants to be.
Yeah.
But let's explore all the choices and find out.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Yeah, because sometimes I know the experience too of listening to actors read something out loud and hearing someone make a choice that I'm like, I get what you're doing there, but I actually think that you're maybe trying too hard to find something different there where it just can be what it is.
But I also believe very, very strongly that if an actor or a director, anybody encountering it while you're still working on it, mm-hmm. asks you a question as a writer, you only have, it's binary, you have two choices. Answer the question because you know the answer and it helps, or rewrite. There's not any other area. There's not some, well, let's spend a week with it and find out. If you can't answer the question and articulate to somebody what you think the answer is, if it's your job to answer the question in that moment, it's often the director's job to answer the question in that moment.
Yeah.
But if you can't help, then just rewrite it.
Yeah.
There are always other words.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter. This is a story I've told a lot, but a very dear friend of mine who's done a lot of my work, we were doing a workshop of something, and it was like half an hour before we did it. And he came to me and he was like, I've tried. I can't. This line, I don't get it. I don't understand. Can we cut it? And I said, sure, just cut it then. And afterwards, because we'd been working together a lot, he's done a lot of my plays or readings of my plays. Afterwards, he said, can I ask you something? Something went across your face when I said, can I cut it? And it's not, I don't know what it was, but it's something I haven't often seen on your face. And I said, oh, it was my favorite line in the play. He said, what do you mean? I said, it was my favorite. It was the reason I wrote the play. I thought that line kind of was everything that I thought the play was. He said, why did you let me cut it? And I said, because it wasn't working and it will never be in the play again. You were right.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was right.
He just watched you have to mourn this thing.
That happened in a split second. Uh-huh. But I was like, oh, that's such a clever turn of phrase. But that goes back to the thing I was saying before. If it's clever, not to say that I don't like things to be clever in the play. I sure do. But if you're too wedded to, well, that one sounds so good, I don't want to lose it, then you're probably doing the wrong job.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot from playwrights and screenwriters who are like, if you like it too much, if you're liking the dialogue too, if you're a little too pleased with yourself, or even just people who write prose, who write books, they say like, if you're getting too excited about your sentence structure and about how smart that is, the way that you worded that, you might need to, that might be the place that you need to just make it a little
bit more. There's a very, very famous author who has a book out right now. He's one of my favorite. I love what he does, but his new novel is easily 200 pages too long because nobody tells him no anymore.
Yeah.
I'm like, people should have told you no. It doesn't mean that those 200 pages aren't entertaining, but at some point, it's just a long train and you're waiting to get to the other side of it in your car. You know, it's just going by car after car. Car.
You've probably heard me talk myself blue in the face about how I think that that's the problem with a lot of long form prose is that I'm like, I know this went through an editing process, but I still think that there's a slimmer version of this that would be a little bit more.
And the streaming model for a lot of film content now, everything now this year suddenly is 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
They probably would have been better at an hour 59.
Yeah.
But because it's streaming.
Yeah,
and you don't have to turn over a theater a certain amount of times a day. Uh-huh. Nobody's sitting on top of these world-class artists and saying, you might want to take another pass. There might be 20 minutes you can get out of that.
Yeah.
Because there's always something that can go.
Yeah, yeah. So hearing actors say it out loud is exhilarating and fun. I agree. And it also teaches us so much about what we're working on. There's only so much. I don't know if you agree with this. You probably do. There's only so much the writer can do on their own as far as editing and rewriting.
At some point it
has to be read aloud and it has to be heard.
Yeah, it's a group project. It's a thing that gets made in a room with other people.
Yeah.
It's why and we don't have to get into the weeds of the development process or how I think the theater is on the verge of being broken by it right now. But if you take a playwright, and put them through 5 years of development on a play, this is particularly true for musicals, the development process is so extenuated now that it doesn't make it past that step of just being in a room with other people. But that room with other people is great, and our goal is to get it in front of other people who are just watching it.
Yeah.
But so many things stall out now in the process of, well, why don't you take another pass and let's do another workshop? Mm-hmm. At some point, you've got to put it in front of people and find out.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
why we're doing it.
Yeah. So how do you like that process? How do you like sitting in the theater when the audience shows up? Is that as fun as hearing actors do it?
I find it 100% of the time painful and excruciating.
See, I was going to say that. I was going to say, because hearing the actors do it is the best.
It's the best.
Getting it in their hands and seeing them get up on their feet and watching it. But I don't think I've ever been like more nervous than sitting in the audience of a play that I wrote.
And it's probably why, because I was an actor for so long, my favorite part of acting is rehearsing. Mm-hmm. I don't like to take a bow. I mean, I like the audience because they're watching it, but they really aren't part of my experience. I know how to weave around them, but my experience is what I'm showing them. But as a writer, I mean, I think the great actors, and I know a lot of them, you're one of them, when they're great at it, they're completely exposed. And as an actor, I don't think I ever have completely unlocked that. There's always something a little careful. I'm a little bit of a craftsman on top of it. And I am 100% exposed as a writer.
Yeah. And see, but I think that too, as an actor. I think that there's always something that's being concealed. It may not look like it, but you know, it's just the feeling internally of being like, I can't fully let go.
My experience of watching you is not that. So, but as a writer, I'm not shy about saying that's all me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, people often ask, and I understand the question, but I don't think it's an accurate question. Which character do you relate with, or which one is most you? All of them.
Yeah.
They're people that I think of them as people. They're people that I'm trying to help have a fully rounded life on the page, but I'm kind of in all of them.
Yeah.
They're all autobiographical. It doesn't matter if they're a science fiction love story set in the future or a gravedigger in the past or you know, I don't know if I should tell this story. I just told this story last night. My first play is this play called The Submission, which some people love and some people hate because it's a very polarizing piece of writing. It was meant to be. I also didn't think anybody would ever read it, so I didn't care.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I'll just say all the things and let people say all the things. But in the course of it being produced in New York, there was a series of directors who were offered the opportunity to direct it. They were all fantastic, and I ended up with somebody fantastic. But one of them was a pretty famous individual who had worked on a lot of new plays and somebody who was a hero of mine. And this person read the play and said they needed to talk to me before agreeing to do it and got on the phone with me. And because that play traffics a lot in questions of race and how we talk to each other about race, this person got on the phone with me and was like, I just have to ask you, a lot of the views expressed in this, are they your views? That was like the first question. And we were like 2 minutes into this conversation. I said, are you asking if I'm a racist? Well, I think I don't want to get involved in this if you're trying to create a platform to get this views out there. I was like, assuming that I agree with everything that somebody who's saying reprehensible things seems... That doesn't seem like a great question to ask.
Yeah.
And also, you know the answer. Like, if I say yes, then you don't want to do it. And if I say no, you're going to think I'm lying. You already have an opinion about that.
Yeah.
But it's such an odd question to ask.
Yeah.
And they kept saying, well, I just want to make sure you don't agree. And I was like, I'll tell you the truth. When I'm writing, and that was my first play, so I hadn't yet established a vocabulary for my ethos.
Sure.
But I did say... I'm trying to write something where I agree with everybody about 50% of the time.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to tell you what things those are. So you can decide that I agree with the things that are most awful. That's your prerogative. But I probably agree with about half because I think that's good playwriting.
Yeah.
I also agree with about half of the things that are on the other side of the argument. And what my hope is, and I do think this separates me from a lot of writers, is I sit down to write because I have a question.
Yeah.
An essential question or several questions about human beings and how incredibly difficult it is for all of us to walk around on this piece of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
So I start to try to ask these questions. And then if I'm a craftsman, my job is to then put something around those questions that's entertaining enough to hold an audience's attention long enough so that when it's done, they might ask similar questions. Because I don't have an answer. And when I finish, I don't have a more developed response. I just have a more developed question. And I'm hoping that I'm passing that question on to a group of people. It's why I mostly write in the intermissionless world, because I think the experience is act one is watch the thing, and act two is go talk about the thing. And that's why I think the advent of the 90-minute, 100-minute play has been really helpful for playwrights, because it allows you, if you're a writer like that, to say that the next act of the play is for you to go and explore the thing you just watched.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of people would say in theory, a lot of writers would say in theory they agree with me, but if you watch what they do, a lot of times I feel like they're answering the question, and I just don't find that as interesting, personally, for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Or as an audience member, because I think as a content creator, as a writer, you write the thing that you would like to see.
Yeah.
Or you create the thing you would want to watch.
Well, and you know, I think that there are audience members who experience things in both of those ways. There are people who enjoy having the question answered, and there are people who don't, and who are like, no, I want to walk away with a debate about who is correct.
And I don't want to, you know? I often say this, I want to intrigue you, but not frustrate you.
Yeah.
So my job in that room with the actors, with the director, is to make sure that the experience, even if it has moments you don't understand as an audience member, you're not sitting back or jumping out, or the screenplay word bumping on it. Like that's,
you
I don't
still
mind
want
it.
It's still a piece of entertainment
that's
too.
Right.
You still
that's
want
right.
people to enjoy watching it.
But people
it,
enjoy
you know?
Things in different ways.
Yeah.
Like I go to things, and my taste tends to run to things that challenge me in a certain way.
Yeah.
I loved Neil Simon. What a great craftsman. That's not what I do when I sit down to write, because it isn't. If you've put five plays in front of me and said, what do you want to buy a ticket to? I'm probably going to buy a ticket to the thing that this is manifest in my career, but the thing that the least people want to see, the least amount of people want to see.
Yeah.
But that's the thing I want to see. So I try to create in that realm. And successfully, the least amount of people have wanted to see me so far. So I'm on fire, Austin.
I did a production of the play Here by Taylor Mack a few years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, you were here? Yeah. Okay, so our production, I think...
Oh, such a good production of that play.
Oh, I'm glad that you liked it. So I was going to say our production, I think one of the problems is that like it wasn't as entertaining or like for the audience as it could have been. But if you enjoy...
It was deeply uncomfortable.
Yes. So, and what happened though, that was so interesting, it was very divisive for the audience and we got very, very mixed responses, but I'd never done a show where every night after the show, I would stay in the lobby talking with people for about an hour afterward. They would stay, the audience would stay, and they would be like wrapped up in heavy discussion. Like I would come out from the dressing room and they would be like fighting it with each other. And they'd be going, no, the mom is right. She is correct.
Right.
And then, you know, like, and they go, no, she's becoming the abuser. She's projecting the abuse that she experienced now back onto her kids, you know, and they're like arguing with each other. And it would, and then they'd ask me, they go, well, here he is. What do you think? You know? And I go, I don't know. I mean, what do you
that's
experience?
Right. What do you think?
And we would sit there and talk, but I thought as tough as that show was for us, the actors, we all talked about how it wasn't fun for us to do. It was very hard. We would, we'd get done with it every night and we'd be like, oh my goodness.
I got beat up a bit.
Yeah. And, but we all agreed like, what an interesting thing that after every night, people are really getting riled up about this.
It means
you
were doing the thing,
you know? Yeah.
And the writer was too.
Yeah.
What an interesting writer Taylor Mack is.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. And it is that, like, it's almost that daring to not really care if you don't make everyone feel the best.
But you also can't control how many people are going to relate to or see a thing.
Yeah.
Of course, I would like everybody to see the thing. Uh-huh. I would like everybody to like the thing.
Yeah.
But that's not the way to make good art.
Yeah.
The way to make good art is to set that aside and make yourself vulnerable to the thing that you're trying to make and hope that people like it.
That's really hard for me because the title of the show of this podcast is
People Pleaser.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It's really hard.
I'm a people pleaser too.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I respect it and I love that's your approach is like it's about questions and I think that's really good.
Well, I think it's also sometimes confusing for people who don't know me because my writing tends to be aggressive in a certain way, and they're surprised that this pretty mild-mannered, you know, like trying to be fairly kind, soft-spoken fella is behind it. But that is the dichotomy that makes,
you know, I've never thought that though. Things. I've never gone to your shows and been like, geez, Jeff's like a really dark guy. Like I've always just thought, oh, Jeff, they're very smart because I think you're really smart. And I don't think that means, I don't mean that you're sitting down at the keyboard going, check me out.
Look at
I
that.
I don't think that you do that from any, like, I don't think it's an intentional or trying to flex to the audience. I just think that it's you, like you said, it has you in it and you have a really great brain. And so every time I've watched one of your things or read one of your things, I'm always like, yeah, he's smart. He's a smart guy, you know? And so
I try.
It's coming out. Yeah. How do you decide in this process? Because so a person writing a book will probably on their own do 5 to 10 drafts before they're working with an editor, maybe.
Right.
And then the editor's got to do their drafts. And maybe before an editor, they even send it to some friends to see if they can get some feedback and do some rounds of cleaning and notes before they start trying to get it published, something like that. It's still a collaborative effort, but it's still largely like that person's going to
solo effort. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and maybe they're working in tandem with an editor on deciding what the final draft is. When you're working with actors and a director and a theater company and everything, in the process that you're in right now,
right.
Like you're actively doing editing in the rehearsal process.
I got 70 pages this week.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was week one of rehearsal.
Yeah. Well, I'm also trying to front load a lot of the changes because they only have 2.5 more weeks.
Yes.
And I want to get out of their way.
Yep. Yep.
But every time they ask me a question, the other day, one of the actors said, so when are you going to stop? And I said, when you stop asking smart questions. If you ask a smart question, I'm going to go home and work on it. That's
especially if it's something I can fix with one line change.
Yeah.
Because if I can fix it with one line change, then I'm going to do it because I trust you to be able to adjust.
Right, but if you get far enough along, and this play has been through, I mean, it's been through a strange development process because we were workshopping it right when the pandemic, literally when the pandemic hit last year, the week of March 14th.
Yeah.
But if you get to the place where we are now, if the play is in really good shape, changing one line or changing three lines can change the entire play.
Yeah.
You know, you've just,
yep.
If that was just this, the entire play looking back and looking forward changes.
Yeah.
But you have to be in that, the play has to be that far along for that
yeah.
to be true.
Yes. Yes.
If that's not true, then you're changing, then you're like rewriting three whole pages.
Right.
When I say I've brought in 70 plus change pages, that means that I've been planting those landmines by changing three lines on this page or one line on this page.
Yep.
Because we've discovered this argument or this sequence doesn't quite do what it wants to do. What if? There have only been, this week I did majorly rewrite one big idea in the play. It's like a 20-page section. But it was an area that me and West Grantham, the director, always knew was still under construction.
Mm-hmm.
But there was only one other like big idea that he one day was like, and he's such a fantastic collaborator. We've worked together for years. But one of the great things about Wes is he's gentle but incisive.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be having a conversation and he'll very quietly say, you know, I've been very curious, but you said this in the play, but you never really like, it doesn't really develop in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to have, he said, you seem to have not even loaded the gun. You like showed the gun, but then the gun never really comes out at the end. You're like, remember, there's a gun. Why is that? Shouldn't we see the gun again? Don't you want to show a bullet? I'm speaking, you know, obviously metaphorically.
Yeah, Chekhov.
And I was like,
yeah.
Like this? And he said, yeah, why doesn't that happen? I said, well, it will tomorrow. And I went home. And that was like three whole pages that was different. But for the most part, everything has been pretty, pretty localized because smart people are asking smart questions.
So I guess, Mike, the question is, in a process like this where rewrites are happening as you're preparing for a production in front of an audience,
right,
how do you decide when it's done, when to step away and say,
because it's opening night?
Yeah, so you just have to.
That I mean, Gravedigger's Lullaby, which you saw,
yeah,
that play on opening night, and the press had already been there, who cared?
Yeah.
But on opening night that morning, I got an email from either one of the two lead actors or the director saying, I still don't understand. I still think we haven't figured out this. And it was a climactic thing in the play.
Yeah.
And it was like a 10-line sequence. And whoever asked the question, I just opened up a dialogue in email between the four of us. And between like 10 a.m. and 11:30 that morning, I started sending emails back and forth asking questions and delivered like 10 different lines. And that night at the end, we were like, that's it. That is the closest representation of, we all feel satisfied with that. We feel like that is satisfying for an audience. And then it was opening night. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And unless and until somebody else is paying to develop it, that's the play. Now that play is published. So once it's published, I really do have to let it go because I can't do anything really, because that's the thing that's licensed and is out there. Mm-hmm. But if, you know, like the submission is a good example, since it was my first play, I still stand by that play. I think some of that play does some really provocative and interesting things, but every time I encounter it, and there have been like 30 or 40 productions of it, I haven't seen all, I don't need to see them anymore. But if I, every once in a while I see that one of them and I think I could really help that guy.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote that, because I'm now 10 plays and 6 musicals in, I now do this every day.
Sure.
And I see what that guy's trying to do, and I could help him now. So,
but isn't that somebody, nice to know?
It is.
Isn't it nice to know?
If somebody asked, if somebody was like, hey, would you be interested in going back under the hood of that play? My answer would be like, yes, 1,000%.
Yeah.
But not just to please myself. It would have to be with a goal in mind.
Yeah, because I'll also say this. Like, I just saw The Matrix this last week, the new one. And I just was like, there's something about filmmakers revisiting something that is beloved. And they do this thing where they fix things that have been bothering them for 20 or 30 years. And that all of us are like, oh no, I liked that.
Don't
fix that.
No, I know.
You know what I mean? And they're like, no guys, trust me. It's been bugging me too. Don't worry. I'm going
to
fix it.
That's why in answer to your question, at some point you just have to walk away.
Yeah.
You
know, because then it's no longer yours.
That's right. That's right. I've actually never articulated it like that. Once you've involved that many people in the creation of it, going back to the solo effort of trying to make it a thing.
Yeah.
I think seems kind of counterproductive to me.
Yeah.
Because it did become other people's. And yes, eventually it became the audience's, but we all started to make a thing together. And back to the topic we were at a couple minutes ago, that is my favorite part. When we're all in the sandbox together with our buckets and with our shovels and building our castles, that's the best time.
Yeah.
Then eventually you have to go sit in the back row as a writer and just feel completely exposed by it. And very vulnerable and very nervous and want to throw up. And that's what it is.
Yep.
That's what it is.
Yep. There also is a magic, though, in that, in sitting in the audience and on the back row and watching and being so nervous. But then when it's happening and you can hear the audience, you hear the gasps from people at certain lines. You hear a laugh to a line that you didn't know was going to get a laugh, but you like it. It's a good laugh. Or you hear... I mean, at the moment when you want, and all of a sudden you hear sniffles in the audience and you go, oh, we did. It's happening.
But
there's a magic.
I do have, because of the nature of the things that I write, I often have the experience at the beginning when the play starts, because, you know, you're laying kind of soft ground for everybody. Mm. I sometimes feel guilty because I know what is about to happen to some of those people.
Uh-huh.
Like I know what's going to happen. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
But some things are going to happen to you in about an hour.
Yeah.
And I feel bad because you might not like that 5 minutes of experiencing that in your life. My hope is on the other side of it, you're glad you had that experience.
Yeah.
But you might experience a little pain in a bit, and I'm so sorry.
I always have this experience too where, like, and this happens especially with songs, where like I'll be working on a song by myself for a few days, you know, or a week or two in my studio, and then I'll take a friend in the car and I'll go, check this out. And I'll put the song on, and instantly I'm like, I don't know how, but it got way worse somehow when
every
you
time.
Got in the car and listened to it.
Every
I don't
time.
Know what happened. It was good, I promise. It was good. Yeah. And then you came in here, and now because you're here and I'm listening to it through the funnel of your ears into mine,
live with a writer. He's a playwright as well, and we're wildly different writers, and he is my first audience member, and I think I am for him, but we're very different writers. So, you know, the minute I get, his name is Ken Jones, he did this play Alabama Story.
It's in my notes. I was literally gonna go, your husband is a playwright.
He is.
Yeah,
but Ken will often read one of my plays, and he is not shy about saying what he thinks. He is the smartest person I've ever met. His notes are 100% of the time right. But we'd try to do different things. So sometimes he'll say, I don't understand this. And I know in the back of my head, eventually it will make sense once I'm with the right people and I'm able to articulate it. So there, but he has a way of, he likes to read a hard copy and he writes on it. And sometimes he just draws a question mark over a whole page and he hands me that page. but oftentimes eventually, I mean, of course it will have changed, but he'll get to see it or see a reading and he'll say, I don't have that question anymore. My question mark is revoked because I see what you were doing, but when I just read it, I didn't take it in. Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful to have people to turn it over to. You asked this a couple minutes ago, but at some point you're still just the person trying to find the thing yourself.
It's also great, it's a though, solo that, event. That you and Ken have that ability to do that, because that's not easy for couples to do. Yeah, to say, hey, look at this. And kind of what you want is like, I just kind of want you to tell me what a genius I am.
I have said that sometimes. I'm always ask a writer if they give me something to read, because I will read whatever anybody asks me to. But I say, where are you? Because do you just need encouragement? Mm-hmm. Or do you want me to actually poke? Because I'll poke.
Yeah.
But if you need to hear that it's great, I'll find all the things that are great in it.
Mm-hmm.
I also find as a road of responding to anything, especially with people you care about, the best way in is always to start with all the things that you love. And it's shocking to me when somebody doesn't return that courtesy to me.
Yes.
I'm like, don't you understand that the way to tell me that you don't like that part of it is to start with the things that you like so that I trust you?
Yeah. No, but seriously.
Start with generosity.
I've had friends who have, like, the way that they've approached responding when I've given them something is to be like, I think you need to, like, go back to school for writing. I think that you need to read. And I'm like, oh, that's not the place to start.
No.
Like, because I'm also like, I know that this isn't, it's not done. I gave it to you. Yeah. And I did tell you to respond with feedback because I'm trying to make it better, but I understand that it's rough, but like, don't approach it going, this is bad. Like, it's like,
or start with the question of what are you trying to do?
Yeah.
You know, engage in that conversation, which is a great way to start that dialogue too. Can you talk to me about what you want it to be? Oh, great. Well, I can tell you that as somebody who just experienced it, that only happens here, or that isn't happening yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's what you want it to do, I can help diagnose that with you.
Mm-hmm.
Or say, oh yeah, it's totally doing that. Hey, good on you. That was my experience for sure.
See, that's the answer to my question. I was going to say, living with another playwright and all that, do you keep your work separate or do you help each other? It sounds like you do.
Well, we're different in that he will share along the journey more than I will.
Mm-hmm.
I like a thing to be a complete idea before I show it to anybody.
Sure.
So it has to be a complete draft that is kind of everything I mean before I even share it with him or with my tight circle of like three or four first readers.
Yeah.
I have the benefit because I also write musicals with Will Van Dyke,
mm-hmm.
and I have somebody on a day-to-day basis who is in process with me on those pieces of writing. Mm-hmm. So that's different. But in terms of the plays, nobody sees them until I've gotten all the way to end of play. And I think it is that lump of clay. Yeah. And then I can like share it with Ken, share it with the three or four other people that I like to share things with early on and talk about the lump.
Yeah.
But I need it to be a lump. And I mean, you'd have to ask Ken. It's his life. It seems like he's a little more comfortable with sharing along the way or even talking. I don't talk about the thing I'm writing until it's that lump.
Yeah.
If people ask me, I'll say, yes, I'm working on something new.
Yeah.
But I don't talk about what it is because inevitably it's like if you're having a baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what you want to name the baby. The advice to all couples is never tell anybody else what you want to call your kid because somebody's going to say Joey is a terrible name.
Yeah.
But if you don't tell them and you show them a baby and you say, this baby's name is Joey, they're going to say, that is the perfect name. Hi, Joey.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and that is the way about, like, I'm very protective about the thing that I'm writing while I'm in the process of it because I don't want anybody to take me off the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because somebody has a really great response that is like, but is that a good idea to write about? I'll abandon it. So I kind of don't want to give them the opportunity to do that until I fully develop at least the idea.
Yeah. I saw a tweet the other day that sort of goes along with the quote that you talked about. I like having written, not write,
yes.
Not the actual process of writing. But I saw a tweet that was like, you can edit a draft. You can't edit a blank page.
I agree.
You know, so you need, it's like just because people, I think, while they're writing a draft, and it can be very frustrating and going, this isn't turning out how I want it to turn out.
Yeah.
Maybe you're just the kind of writer who just needs to get to some version of end of play.
Yeah.
So that you can then go, okay, what is this? What is it?
What's outline particularly. I outline about halfway through. Mm-hmm. Once it's kind of revealed itself to me, then I go back and be like, oh, but there needs to be a scene here that does that. And I can now see that the next four scenes need to be X, Y, and Z. I'm more structured in the musical writing because I'm working with somebody else, and musicals have a lot of rules, most of which I enjoy breaking, but those rules exist. Mm-hmm. So that you do kind of have to have a stronger idea.
Sure.
Let's talk about what the last song might be so mm-hmm. that I kind of, so we both kind of know what we're writing towards. But in a play, I don't usually know what the last song is going to be. I kind of probably know what I hope. Like, I hope this destination ends with these two people, blah, 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 blah. But I'm always wrong.
Well, God.
I'm always wrong.
Aren't endings just the fucking worst though? Yes. Too. I God, my friend sent me a Sam Shepard quote the other day where he was like, I hate endings. Beginnings are great. They're so exciting. Middles are confusing and messy, and endings are the worst. And yeah. I just was like, well, that's the metaphor for everything in life is everything yeah. is exciting when it begins. The middle is weird and confusing.
Yes.
And the ending is really hard.
Oh, here's you'll like this one too. This is, yeah. I'm going to mangle it. This isn't exactly what he said, but this is an Edward Albee quote that I like a yeah. lot. It's something along the lines of, if a play can be described in 10 words, that should be its length. So when somebody's asking you for a synopsis,
yeah.
if you can describe it, if you can pitch it like in an elevator and say, well, you know, it's Grease meets Man of La Mancha with a little bit of, you know, Survivor in it. It's probably not great is yeah. what he's saying. Because if you can really describe it, probably sucks.
Yeah.
That's just the concept.
Well, and that's why whenever you ask, we sound so pretentious when we do this, but when people ask, you know, quote unquote, serious artists about like, what kind of music do you make? Or what's your podcast about? It's always like, I don't know. There's 100 episodes of this thing.
Yeah.
And it's not.
And each one is about each chapter is about a different thing.
And then a play, it's like, there's a lot of, there's themes.
Yeah.
There are themes on themes.
Yes.
And there are questions on questions. And there are things that I think it's about, and there's things that people who have seen it think it's about.
But you're going to think it's about something different than I think it's about.
So, yeah.
Every time.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to give people the freedom to say what they think it's about. They're not going to agree with me. I would like two people sitting next to each other to have it be about something different for each of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, you develop a log line that you can tell people.
It's
yes. It's a loose adaptation of this.
Yes,
it's
that's right. That's yeah, right.
You know, but then you're like, but it's not that. But
it isn't. Like this particular play that we're talking about that I'm working on right now started with an Ibsen play.
Yeah.
And I thought I would just adapt it. I really did. Mm-hmm. Wes and I proposed an adaptation of the play to Karen Eisenberg, the fantastic artistic director.
Mm-hmm.
But I got like, I read his play. I love him. And I read it and I was like, I bless you. I love you, Henrik. You're amazing. I don't want to write a play about a couple of men standing in the middle of the room talking to each other.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that enough. Mm-hmm. I wonder what happens if two women are talking to each other.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about mm-hmm. opening up and exploring.
That's one of my, right off the bat, I'm like, ooh, this is fun.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And I really very quickly abandoned, beyond the structure of story that he established. His play is a play about a small town where something's happening and one person is trying to fix it and everybody has turned against that person. That's the only similarity to our play. My play has nothing to do with his play except for it borrows his story structure. And I hope that in the end is then in conversation with his play. You know, a
sure.
couple hundred years later, 140 years later, then we're in a conversation. Like he presented some ideas and now I'm saying with all the knowledge of the last 140 years, here are some new perspectives on those ideas. Let's talk to each other. You're no longer around. This is the only way we can talk. So I'm going to write. Some of my people are going to be called the same things as some of your people, but they're not your people anymore. They're their own people. But if anything, they started as my people now.
Now, because you talk about March 2020 when you were pitching, did the pandemic influence the wanting to write this or did it come before? That's so crazy.
No, the draft was
That's
already
so crazy.
Done. The play starts with the suggestions of a pandemic and none of the writing around the disease that is being talked about in the play has changed.
Wow.
That week, because it was the week of March 14th, we were in rehearsal every day as things were melting down around us. We definitely were in conversations that were influencing some of the writing, but I didn't sit down to, I don't want to talk about a pandemic. I want to talk about how the press deals with a pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the actualities of the thing are less important to me than how we deal with the thing.
Mm-hmm.
That said, for better or worse, the play has taken on a kind of a resonance that didn't exist 19, 21 months ago
yeah.
because of what we're still going through.
What is actively happening.
Yeah, what is actively happening mm-hmm. today. But that is not as interesting to me as how we respond to it.
Sure.
And the thing that has kind of grown as I've worked on it is it started to be for me a play about the press. This is for me is operative there because it'll be something else, somebody else. But it started to be a play about the press, but really for me what it has come to be, and I've been writing about this a lot now, is how are we going to talk to each other mm-hmm. in this place that we're all building together? We seem to have lost the ability to talk to the people we don't agree with.
Yeah.
And if we don't figure that out, we're going to be two places.
Yeah.
We might be two places.
Yep.
But I would prefer if we try to keep building a bridge between the two places mm-hmm. so we're one place. I want to be one place.
Gal, I talked to this guy recently who was telling me that we were talking about building bridges, and he was a person who was on the opposite political spectrum
sure.
of me, probably about as far as he can get. He invited me to come on a live stream and talk with him, and we were talking, and he said, I just want to find a way to build a bridge instead of two sides yelling at each other
yeah.
about how to build the bridge from opposite sides. And I said, yeah, but you know, sometimes I feel like I'm on a team that's in a boat that's throwing a bag of tools to you and your team, and you're taking the bag of tools and dumping it in the water. And I'm going, please don't do that. We're trying to build
right.
the bridge. And that's what I feel like sometimes. And
but I'm
like,
sure that he would say, I feel
yeah,
the same way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if we don't engage in the conversation, we certainly aren't going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Of course, there are people you can't... Of course, there are ways to not have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are ways to have the conversation. I don't know what the end of that conversation is, but we have to at least engage in the conversation or we're going to stop talking.
Yes, yes. And I like, you know, and the scary thing that we're going to be two places because
yeah.
that's also looming.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we got to talk a little bit about this play. Let's just plug it for a little bit.
Sure.
Just so like, because there's people in Utah, and if
there
maybe they want to travel to Utah, or maybe they're a person who has a local theater that they have some influence
totally.
On and they want to produce this play.
Yes.
So it's The Messenger.
It's called The Messenger.
Yeah.
My name's Jeff Talbot.
Uh-huh.
It happens in Pioneer Theater Company in Salt Lake City from January 14th through January 29th. I will say that it has an extraordinary group of actors working on it.
Mm-hmm.
The principal six, five are from New York. One is an absolutely astonishing female actor from Chicago. She's a member of the Steppenwolf Ensemble.
Awesome.
And they're tearing their way through it, and it's super fun. I do think the play is a rollicking ride.
Yeah.
My last play here was, I think, a good ride too, but a kind of a more solemn ride. This is a hopefully you're sitting on the edge of your seat for 93-ish minutes.
This has a much more crackling energy,
yeah.
I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. a train. Like, it's
yeah.
a ride, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
To completely surprise you at several points as to where the ride is going, but you're on a ride.
Very exciting. The last thing I want to talk to you about
yes.
is just, it's sort of an offshoot, but it's every year, and I'm not on Facebook anymore, so you might have already done this, but every year you write this amazing list of your round.
Movies?
It's like my favorite thing in the world because you're so good at it. And
well,
you're such
on the I email it to you. I email it
okay,
out.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I'm so excited to see it. This Have you done it? You haven't done it yet.
No,
year.
I wait until January 31st.
Yeah, because you got
December 31st. I still have a couple to see.
Got to see some more.
I'm
yeah.
not going to get to everything. Like
uh-huh.
I'm very excited about the tragedy of Macbeth, but it doesn't open here in Salt Lake till after I'll probably do the list.
Yeah.
But there are a couple more that I feel like I have to see. I just haven't. And what I do is I have a list of this year. It'll probably be around 180 movies, and I just sit and work my way through it and discard things until I have a list of about 30, and then I get it down to a manageable amount.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because were you about to ask what movies did I love this year?
Yeah, I was going to ask. Like, give me like five. Like that you think are going to make the list.
I'm pretty sure Pig will be on the list.
Okay, yeah. I just watched that a few months ago.
Did you like it?
You know what? I think it was so hyped up for me for so many people that they were
too small. To,
yeah,
yeah.
They were like, it's gonna blow you away, and I was like,
no,
I like it. I was like, I do like it. I like people who do different things, and I just like that it's like not a movie that I see a lot.
Yeah.
But
I really loved
yeah.
it. West Side Story was a big experience for me because I didn't expect it to be great. I really love Spider-Man No Way Home. I doubt that'll end up on my top 10. But,
yeah.
Because usually I end up more like what's a good foreign film? Like
sure, sure.
You know, I try to keep it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm drawn to sad foreign films anyway, but it's a more democratic list. I try to, if there's three animated films on it, that's probably means I am not paying attention to something.
Did you feel like this year was kind of like, sometimes I feel like there's just so many good movies, and I felt like this year
was better for TV than movies.
Yeah, it was a little rough, but maybe that's because of the pandemic that it's
but
just hard.
But I also found some really great small stuff. There's a really great movie called Test Pattern. That's like a 78-minute film about a young couple. Oh, it's so great. It's so great. It's about a young couple. Something happens to the female in the couple that they have to deal with in the medical community. Mm-hmm. And it's just like 24 hours of them trying to go from hospital to hospital to deal with this thing.
Okay.
And it's an interracial couple. And it's a really fascinating film about men and women and race. Yeah. And it happens in a really succinct amount of time. There's a really wonderful Israeli film called Sublet that stars the actor John Benjamin Hickey. It's about a guy who goes to Tel Aviv to write, and he sublets a B&B from a young Israeli guy. And it's about the relationship that pops up between them, and it's gorgeous and tiny and small. That'll probably be in there somewhere. I'm trying to think because I forget.
I know. Yeah, you have to like look at the list.
I'd have to look it up. There's a fantastic Norwegian film by this 80-year-old absurdist Norwegian filmmaker. It's on Hulu now. It's called, I'm going to look it up while I'm talking. It's called, what is it called? He makes these crazy films that are kind of Beckett vignettes about sad Norwegian people walking through their days.
Yeah.
It's called About Endlessness.
What'd you think about French Dispatch?
I love him so much.
Yeah.
I wanted to love it so much, which is a bad way to go into a film.
Sure.
I loved it.
Yeah.
But I found that the thing that is amazing about his brain is how he visualizes this world that is unlike anything else, but it can be exhausting if it's not attached to real people.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't always feel like it was attached to breathing people. So it was so amazing.
There were certain sequences that were incredible.
Bit listless with it sometimes.
Yeah. Yep. I thought most people I talked to, like everyone's favorite section, I think, was the Benicio del Toro section.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
It felt like, and he was doing such a wonderful job.
But it was also the first section.
Yeah.
Because I think it got a little tiring.
Yeah.
But I will say that at the end of it, when he got to popping up the names of all the journalists in the New Yorker, I was deeply moved.
Yeah.
Like I started to cry because it felt like a tribute to what those people do.
Well, that's what the movie felt like, was like this love letter to writers.
Yes.
It also made it so that the dialogue was like among his most verbose screenplays, where you're like, oh, I'm having a little bit of a hard time following this. Like
staying with
him.
There are two. One I think I need to see again. I think I need to watch Power of the Dog again.
Mm-hmm.
Have you watched it?
No.
It's Jane Campion's film. It's on Netflix. It's Benedict Cumberbatch. A lot of people, it's their favorite film of the year.
Oh.
I thought it was great.
Yeah.
But I didn't have that experience with it. And some things you need to see a second time.
Yeah.
Or some things I love that end up on my list and then I watch them later. I'm like, oh, that was a really good Tuesday, because I don't feel the same way about it now.
Yeah.
But the other film I'm biased because it's possibly my favorite American filmmaker, but Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, Licorice Pizza.
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
Is so utterly delightful.
Yeah.
It's like 2 hours and 7 minutes of just pure delight of what it is to be 15, 17 and love someone for the first time.
Yep.
It doesn't always make literal sense, but the vibe of it is so delightful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that one really has stuck with me too.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for doing it. I'm glad we got to talk about your play.
Oh, me too.
And about writing plays. And it's just good to see you.
I love your podcasts. I love everything you do.
I
told you off mic, but I will tell it publicly to everyone. I just love what he's blushing right now, which is fantastic. But I just love what you do. And having been someone who's known you for, you know, almost a decade now, or 7 years or so, watching you, I feel a little emotional, but watching what you do is so moving to me. I just love what you do.
Oh, man. Dude. I really, really appreciate it. You know, you've gotten to see quite a metamorphosis and that person was
there too. But first of all, to have it find an audience, but also to watch you, and this is the thing we've been talking about the whole time, to watch you develop and then amplify your voice as a creator is it's so moving to me. It's so amazing.
Well, thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah, you means, didn't expect that. I didn't expect
no,
that.
No, it means
either,
a lot. So.
Don't cut it out.
It means a lot. I won't cut it out. I love being complimented, and I'm
great.
And I want everyone to hear me be complimented. So, okay. Well, thanks. Good luck on the rest of the process.
Thanks.
And,
come see The Messenger. It's a Pioneer Theater Company in January.
Very excited. Okay.
Awesome.
Bye.
Bye.
Don't I have smart, talented friends, and aren't I lucky? How did I get so lucky, huh? That's one of my favorite things about doing what I do. It's one of my favorite things about being in the profession that I'm in, is the people that I meet. I get to meet really talented, cool, interesting people all the time, and I get to call them my peers. I get to sit across from them and learn from them and drink up their knowledge, and I get to call them my peers and my friends. It's so cool. I'm so grateful to be doing what I'm doing, and I'm so grateful to have people like Jeff in my life. Again, go and see his play if you can, if you're in Utah. If you're not in Utah, look up where you can get one of Jeff's plays. He's got several that are published, and you could get one of his plays and read it and be like, oh, this is that guy that I listened to on the podcast. That's Jeff Talbot. Yeah. Anyway, it's great, and I really enjoyed talking with him. I hope you enjoyed listening. I don't really have anything else to say. Do you know that I record these at the same time that I record the intro? Have you figured that out at this point in listening to the show? Or do you think that, like, in your mind, chronologically, is it like, I record the intro, then I go and do the interview, and then I record the outro? Is that what you think? If that's what you think, little peek behind the curtain for you, that's not what happens. I record the interview first, and then I record the intro and outro at the same time. So I literally just recorded the intro, stopped, went to the end of the episode, and now I'm doing this. And I'm just sitting in my room in the one bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. Just a little bit of insight for you. Okay. Hey, here's something fun. Some of you have already checked this out, but if you haven't, I was on a podcast called Mormon Stories, which was it's a big deal in Utah in the ex-Mormon culture and in kind of like the progressive Mormon culture. People who are in the Mormon faith who want the freedom to speak openly about their faith and things like that. It's this guy John DeLynn who's been doing it for 16 years. And it's a very popular podcast, and I got to do a big, long episode. John does these really long, in-depth conversations. You can watch the entire thing on YouTube. Part one is like 2.5 hours long. Part two is like 4 hours and 45 minutes long. So if you want to watch me talk about my life for over 7 hours, you can do that now. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube. It's filmed in with really nice cameras. It's really fun to watch. Or you can listen to it in podcast form. The podcast is called Mormon Stories. And if you search Mormon Stories Austin Archer on YouTube or where you get your podcast, you can check that out. It's sort of like my whole story, my whole Mormon story. And then we go into alcoholism, and we go into getting mildly internet famous and all of that stuff. And it's fun. It's a good time. If you haven't already checked it out, go check that out. Okie dokie. I'll see y'all next week. Be safe out there. It's really raging out there, isn't it? The coronavirus, the Omicron. So be safe, you know. Get back to how you were near the beginning. We know more about it, so we're not all like going around being like, I have no idea what to do. But, you know, bring your hand sanitizer around with you. Wear a mask. Social distance. Don't do things that are unnecessary. Just try to stay safe if you can. Let's try to keep the death toll down. Let's try to keep the ICUs as unpacked as we possibly can. All right, People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com. That's my website, or to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or by looking up Austin Archer wherever you stream your music. My music is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn. Chris Bjorn also mixes and masters this podcast. If you want to work with Chris and have him mix and master your thing, go to themarmalademusic.com and tell tell him I sent you. Say, I heard about you on Austin's podcast. I want to do a project with you. And Chris is going to give you 20% off of your first project just because you said that I sent you. Okay? So go and do that. Chris is the best, and he's my best friend, and I love him very much, and it's his birthday this week or next week, and he's really old, and I love him, and I love all of you, and take care of yourselves, be nice to each other. Okay, talk to you next week. Bye-bye.